You're listening to a free show on WrestlingObserver.com, the leaders in news and inside information on both professional wrestling and mixed martial arts. To learn how to subscribe and get immediate access to hundreds of past newsletters written by Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez, as well as thousands of hours of podcasts and interviews, go to bit.ly/JNPO subscribe. That's bit.ly/JNPO subscribe. Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 32 of Josh Nason's Punch Out. I am Josh Nason, writer, editor, and podcaster for WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome back. We are here in the meat of the MMA sandwich this week. We have events on either side of us, a ton of news happening, all kinds of stuff going on. It's what we really like. So I jumped in the old Rolodex and figured who better to talk to than one of the top reporters on the scene right now, one of the top beat reporters, the last man standing for ESPN.com. He is Brett Okamoto. Brett and I talked for about an hour, as is the usual case around these parts. We talked about his history writing with ESPN.com, how he actually got there, which is a pretty cool story. We discussed, obviously, all the news of the week. We talked a lot about Benson Henderson's free agency, talked about Cain Velasquez and what's next for him, his back surgery when successful, which is good. However, there's some issues there. Talked a little bit about Will Brooks. And, of course, we talked about UFC Fight Night happening in Las Vegas this Saturday. No longer a pay-per-view, but an interesting Fight Night card. And on the prelims, we have essentially the play-in game, if you will, the fight-in game match between Mickey Gall and Michael Jackson. This is such a weird Vegas-only fight, right? The winner, or actually, if Mickey Gall wins, he gets CM Punk. If he does not win, obviously that's off the table for Michael Jackson, which is really strange. And we talk a lot about that, all kinds of other news. I will note that this was recorded at 6 o'clock Eastern on a Wednesday night. The reason I say this is because obviously that was before news broke about Donald Cerrone and Tim Means. And that was what broke, news that broke before Rockhold and Weidman 2 was announced. So I'm going to give you some quick thoughts about that after the interview, which we're going to get to right now with ESPN.com's Brett Okamoto. So our guest this week should be a familiar name to any MMA fan. He's a former writer for the Las Vegas Sun and the Las Vegas Weekly, and you can read his work on ESPN.com. Obviously, you can see him on Cage Side on camera quite often. Tonight, we go to Las Vegas, Nevada, and we welcome 2000 Ohio Promising Young Talent Award winner Brett Okamoto to Josh Nason's Punch-Out. And Brett, with that intro, I have to warn you, we do start out our guests with very tough questions, a tough question to kind of set the stage and everything, and here we go. Have you ever gone to work and battled strep throat?
You know what? I don't think I have ever gone to work and battled strep throat. I want to say I've only had strep throat once in my entire life, and it was when I was very young, so not working at all. I wouldn't know what that's like. In particular, I wouldn't know what it's like to if my job was a professional athlete, if that's where you're going with this.
Exactly, exactly. And we will get to everything about strep throat and everything about Sage Northcutt, UFC coming up this weekend in Las Vegas, a lot different card than what originally you started out at, Benson Henderson, some other stuff. But first, before we go to that, I wanted to ask you, because you live in Las Vegas now, correct?
I do, yeah.
How is your excitement level fluctuating, your heart racing and so on, with the potential news, or the news that potentially you could have an NFL team in your city in just a few years?
You know what, man? To be completely honest with you, it's not fluctuating really much at all. I mean, when I talk to my friends about it and we have those conversations about, you know, could there be a team here? I used to get excited about this. Yeah, I've been living in Las Vegas for 8 years, and it seems like these kinds of conversations continually come up, and you're always let down. So I guess I'm like an MMA fan with the UFC in New York. You know, I think that that's probably a good comparison. I keep getting my hopes up, and then it doesn't happen. So I think the Raiders would make a great fit in Las Vegas, but I'm not necessarily holding my breath just yet that they're going to be here.
Do you think that the outside world, and I say that making it seem like Las Vegas is within a dome or something like that, but there's always this, you hear about this, you know, all the major sports leagues are concerned about gambling and the, that effect it could have on outcomes and sports played there, and so on and so forth. And that's been like a big reason why major league teams have never gone there. Do you get that sense living there that that would be an issue, or do you think it's one of those things that people kind of make too big of a deal out of it?
No, and to be honest with you, it's not a story that I've necessarily followed super close, but I do have some friends, you know, who do general sports radio out here in Las Vegas, and they seem to think that that is a concern with the sports leagues, and they seem to think it's a ridiculous concern because sports gambling is going on all over this country. It's not just in Las Vegas.
Right.
So yeah, I do think that that is part of it. But I would definitely not be an expert to speak to on something like that. But I do think that yeah, it has somewhat of a negative effect on it when people are discussing these possibilities.
So I go and mention in the open your history of writing. Clearly, the year 2000, winning that promising young talent award, as many of us have written and have entered in contests, winning these early stage awards. So you've been writing obviously for a long time in some form or fashion. Obviously, I mentioned some of the other publications you work for. Most recently, obviously ESPN. I think everyone knows your work at this point, doing great stuff there. How did you first hook up with ESPN?
They gave me a call out of the blue. I was standing in an airport. I believe I was flying to Boston to cover a UFC card. That would have been the card that Couture fought Tony on. I think Edgar fought fight BJ on that card, I believe.
Yeah, that was actually August 2010. I'm about an hour outside of Boston, so I remember that card very well.
There you go. I'm pretty sure that was the one I was flying to, and I'll never forget, you know, standing in the airport, getting ready to fly out to that, and you know, getting a phone call from ESPN saying, "Would you have interest in working for us and covering MMA for us?" Because at that time, you know, they had a content partnership with SureDog, but they didn't really have any of their own writers. They had a guy who would do a column here and there, but it was at that point that they decided to bring some writers on, and you know, that was of course an exciting moment in my career. I was probably 25, I think, at that time. So I'd only been covering the sport for 2 years, and to have ESPN show interest, and then sort of the things that they were talking about doing, it was awesome. So that's how did I end up at ESPN? They just gave me a call and basically offered me a job.
That's awesome. So you obviously, the people remember Josh Gross was a part of that group, Chuck Mendenhall, and obviously MMA Live, people remember that show. And a lot of things have changed over the years. Obviously, the department's kind of whittled down. I believe are you the only full-time MMA reporter for them?
I am, yeah.
Okay. So you find yourself in this, obviously ESPN covering all the major sports so much, all these partnerships and so on. You find yourself kind of in a unique spot where you have, you cover sport that becomes interesting to the mainstream sports fan when the big stars are out and kind of, you know, is part of the regular sports diet other times. How have you had to adjust your coverage and through this time? And do you do things differently now than you did, say, when you first got hired back in 2010?
Yeah, it's a focus on the mainstream stories. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I'd be lying to you if I said that it wasn't. I mean, that's as a department with limited resources and just myself. But, you know, ESPN across the board has really, you know, with the layoffs of that they had this year, it's true of any media company, really, that you're trying to do more with limited resources, and we're no different. So, yeah, it's more of a concentration on mainstream stories, but at the same time, I am a full-time MMA writer. There's so many interesting aspects of this sport to cover. So personally, I'm always following every story. I'm in constant contact with people talking about what's going on in the sport at all times. It's just that you tend, of course, to get the higher ups' attention at ESPN when there's a Conor McGregor related, when there's a, you know, Ronda Rousey related, John Jones. That's when you have those conversations with those guys up top. But You know, on the base level, myself, my editors, you know, we're chasing every story just like anybody else out there. It's just, there's sometimes more of a concentration a little bit on the bigger stories, because that's what our bosses want.
Do you remember the first day you saw your name, on an ESPN byline?
Yeah, I can remember one of the first stories I ever wrote for ESPN. It was about Thiago Silva, actually. It was, I can't remember exactly what fight it was. It might have been the time when he ended up failing his drug test afterwards. But it was a fun story. I mean, I remember meeting up with him at the MGM and just speaking with him and a translator, and we talked about his life growing up in the favelas and all that. And Thiago Silva, unfortunately, is now, you know, not, he won't be remembered as potentially he might have been due to some of, you know, the problems he's had outside of the cage. But at that time, it was an amazing story to hear about, you know, a kid coming up from the favelas. And as I'm sure you know, a lot of journalists, that's what they get into this career for, is hearing those kinds of stories and sharing them with people. So yeah, I do remember my first story with ESPN, and it was on that topic.
That's awesome. A few more stories, and we'll move on to some of the news of the week. You know, a lot of people, they've heard about this mega Bristol campus, obviously the one in LA, and so on. Have you been to either campus, and can you describe for the average person that hasn't been there, maybe what it's like when you go there in that environment?
Yeah, the Bristol campus is the main hub. That's where you want to go. That's the exciting one. And when it's kind of funny, because the town that it's in, that's basically it. I mean, you go to Bristol, Connecticut. You know, I hope I don't offend anybody who's living over there, but I don't think there's many attractions that go far beyond going to the ESPN campus. So, and I tend to always go there when it's freezing cold. I don't know why. But for whatever reason, I happen to go there in the winter. I don't think I've ever been there when the weather's nice. So it's freezing. You know, and you've got these buildings, which these huge satellite dishes, and from the outside, it's actually not that exciting. But then once you get inside and, you know, you see these studios, and you got former professional athletes walking around who are doing analyst roles, and, you know, these guys who host SportsCenter are just sitting at their desks right there, you know, having conversations. They're in the cafeteria. It's kind of crazy how, you know, they produce these shows and this content, and, you know, whether it's web or whether it's on television, that reach such a huge audience all over the world. But it feels like kind of a small world when you get over on that campus. You know, I mean, everyone's kind of consolidated, and like I said, you see everybody in the cafeteria. There's basically one major cafeteria in the middle of the place where everybody goes to. So, it's interesting, man. And it's fun anytime I go out there.
Is there anyone that you've seen, in person? I don't want to say starstruck, but anyone that you've been like, wow, this, I actually am a coworker with this person. Anyone in those trips that you've noticed and been like, wow, I can't believe I'm with this person's in the same environment.
I can't remember what my connecting flight was, but I was flying out there, and I was sitting in a small airport. It was somewhere on the East Coast, and I happened to be sitting right next to Flip Saunders.
Oh, okay.
And I always thought Flip was you know, a real talented, knowledgeable guy, obviously. And so that was one, you know, where I was like, hey, this is Flip Saunders. We're both flying to Hartford, and we're going to have to get her in a rental car and drive 45 minutes to go up to the ESPN campus. And he's going to be talking about basketball, and I'm going to be doing MMA meetings. And that's kind of cool. You know, it's a fun job. It's a fun network of people.
That's cool. For those that don't know, Flip Saunders, longtime professional basketball coach, won titles in the ABA, actually died in 2015 of cancer. And go search his story, because it's, you know, the Timberwolves. Really fascinating last stop for him, and some of the things he did for them. Some really interesting stuff. So yeah, interesting story. Let's go to some other interesting stories. And I think I'd say what leads off the top of the week for news is Benson Henderson. For those that don't know, and if you listen to the show, I don't know how you don't know this at this point, but that he is signed with Bellator, and he already has his first fight scheduled, fighting Andre Koreshkov for the promotion's welterweight title in April in Connecticut. I believe it's going to be at the Mohegan Sun. And I guess we'll start with, because this news kind of came bang this week. Were you surprised that he signed with Bellator? And I guess we'll start there. What was your first instincts after you found out that he signed with Bellator?
Well, I think for a long time, people had known that, Ben was going to be somebody who went out and tested his value in free agency. It was something that he wanted to do. I don't think that was like a really well-kept secret in the MMA world. I had kind of thought that the UFC would match the rights. I mean, obviously that's up to a certain limit. I had no idea what Bellator was going to value him at. But I thought that at least there was a good chance that the UFC would exercise its matching rights and keep Ben under contract. So was I surprised? No, I wasn't surprised that Ben went to Bellator. I wasn't surprised that he was willing to go to Bellator. And I can't even say I was shocked that UFC decided not to match his contract. I just, I guess it's at this point, it's kind of just surprising to see somebody switch promotions just because it's not something that we see every day. And so I think in that sense, even though you can walk yourself through it and it all makes sense to you, and there were rumblings that this was going to happen anyway, and that Ben wanted to test free agency. And by the way, he even got an offer from one championship as well.
Oh, okay.
So you knew that all of these things were taking place, and you knew there was a chance he could leave, but you just don't see it. We haven't seen it, you know, very much. Especially of guys of Ben's stature who is still arguably in the prime of his career, that I guess in that way it was surprising. But if you really followed the story and knew Ben and, you know, what he was willing to do, and he was willing to step out on that limb and take the better option for his family, then it wasn't terribly surprising.
Yeah. What I found interesting when this whole thing started after he beat George Masvidal was, you know, it's basically, it really came down to what, you know, what every fighter looks at: the money, the opportunity, and also the flexibility and that you have when you go there to a new promotion. And obviously the money, if he was really thinking, you know, competition wise that I've already won titles at WEC, I've won titles in the UFC, so I've really accomplished my goals there. Am I going to get near a title shot in the next year? I could, but it's going to take, obviously, as we've seen, a confluence of things to happen to come fruition for that to happen. Do I have a better opportunity in Bellator? Am I going to get paid? The Reebok deal obviously factors in, and also what's my flexibility there with fighting and fighting between divisions and all that stuff. I think it makes perfect sense, and for somebody that he's going to have the opportunity to fight interesting fights, and I think that's a good thing. He's going to get a chance to be on Spike TV in front of a lot of people. And obviously the money must have been right. And you heard Dana White allude to he took basically more upfront money as opposed to, you know, this, you know, he would have get escalators if he had championship fights and all this stuff. But there's a big question mark whether that would have happened. I mean, to me, it's just, this is perfect, for him, a great situation, and somebody that's not a megastar. I don't think it's a game changer for them, but somebody that is a real solid hand, and somebody that's not a Ken Shamrock, a Royce Gracie, a Kimbo Slice, to add some legitimacy in there for some of these big shows. I love the move.
Yeah, of course. I love the move for Bellator. And I do not disagree with anything that you just mentioned about why it made sense for Ben, you know. And I think that there probably was a moment of self reflection for Ben, if you want to call that, saying, you know what, if I was ever going to be a major pay-per-view star, it probably would have happened by now. You know, if I was ever going to be that guy who could sell 500,000 pay-per-views, it probably would have happened after I had won the title. I was defending the title. I was getting those opportunities to fight on network television and increase my brand, all that stuff. I was a champion in the WEC. It probably would have happened, you know? So for him to go back to the UFC and sure, if he's able to reclaim a title in arguably the two most stacked divisions in the UFC, the welterweight division and the lightweight division, he's already fought a lot of the guys at the top. So that's going to hinder him in terms of just matchmaking what the UFC would put, who the UFC would put him against, and if they're going to put him on a fast track to the title or not. He probably looked at it and said, I can be as confident as I am in my skill set, but the chances of me reclaiming the title, hanging onto it for a long time, and becoming a mega draw pay-per-view where the real money comes in the UFC, you know, I don't know how realistic that is. Is it possible? Sure. But then you have this other offer from Bellator that has a lot more guaranteed money. So you bring up Dana White's comments, and I think that they're probably accurate. He's saying, hey, if the guy would have came over and become a champion again in the UFC, he would have made a lot more money, but he decided to take more upfront. I think that there is some truth in that. And when you look at it through Benson Henderson's eyes, and what was on the table, and he can get the sponsorship dollars. He doesn't have to get take $15,000 a fight by Reebok. He can go out and find his own. It probably does turn into a much more lucrative and for lack of a better word, safer contract for him at Bellator.
Yeah, I agree. I'm wondering if, when Phil Davis jumped to Bellator, obviously that was interesting. I think a lot of people were curious about, a guy that's still in his athletic prime and kind of hit a certain ceiling in the UFC, obviously never got a title shot, but I think people kind of knew what they had in Phil Davis. He decides to go to Bellator and is already starting to make some waves there and has some interesting fights for him down the road. But now you have Benson Henderson, someone that may be a little bit more high profile, obviously a former UFC champion, like I mentioned, and all that. I wonder if by doing this, people are always scared to trailblaze, it seems, and especially in pro sports. A lot are scared to go first. But now that you have these guys that are showing, hey, you can go over and there's money over here to be made and there's opportunity. I mean, you look, this guy's getting a title shot, his first fight in. I wonder if this really is ushering in a new comfort level with guys fighting out their contracts and going to free agency to see what they're worth, both with Bellator, World Series of Fighting, one, and just be to kind of expand the marketplace a little bit. I feel like people are more, fighters feel to be more confident in saying, I'm going to say what I'm, go see what I'm worth, and I want to have the opportunity to choose between offers as opposed to just the UFC.
I think so. And I think some people make the, they can't differentiate between the two, that a good free agent market, and then they immediately jump to, well, that means the UFC is going to lose a lot of talent. Well, not necessarily. I mean, the UFC still has matching rights to, the guys that they have under contract right now. It works both ways. You see Will Brooks saying that he's going to fight out his contract in Bellator and then find out what he's worth. Mm-hmm. So the UFC can pull guys from other organizations as well. So we're not talking about necessarily this mass exodus of talent from the UFC. Although, since they have the majority of the talent right now, of course, if it could even things out a little bit in that regard, just because they happen to be the front runner right now when it comes to talent. But what I'm more referring to, and I think, most people who follow the sport very closely, is the free agent market, that part of it. That's the part of it that I think guys are more interested in. It's not, I want to leave the UFC. I want to go to Bellator because that's what Ben did. It's about, like you said, finding out what happens in free agency, being willing to fight out their contract. If before these guys started doing this and it was proven, that you could get an offer and that, UFC would match it and you could really find out, get a better gauge of what you're worth, you were kind of flying somewhat blind, trying to compare yourself to what other guys were making if you could find that information out. And it was tempting. It was very tempting to sign a contract extension, even if you weren't completely comfortable with it. Now, if you don't get the offer of a contract extension that you want, then you do have that other second option, and it feels more real every time someone else does it.
Mm-hmm. So we have still outstanding free agents, Alistair Overeem, Matt Mitrione, Aljamain Sterling. What do you make of the prospects for those three guys? And if you were guiding them along and looking for opportunities, just like Benson Henderson, where would you guide them in going?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because each guy is very different. With Ben, you had a guy who could represent you on free television. He had never really been a high pay-per-view draw. He's 32 years old. He can fight in multiple weight classes. So there's one individual. With Aljamain Sterling, he's, 25 years old? Mm-hmm. Not a guy who can really get you ratings yet, but is extremely talented. Has more shelf life than necessarily Ben Henderson does. Has more potential. You're not sure exactly what you have with him, whereas Ben, you do. And then Overeem, probably looked at as more towards the end of his career, I would suggest, even more so than Ben. Not calling him an old man or by any stretch of imagination, but it, probably a little bit past his prime now at this point. But he's a guy who can really move the needle in a significant way in terms of pay-per-views and areas that Ben really has not proven the ability to do. So it's an interesting question because you can't really give one set of advice to three guys who are completely different circumstances. I think, yep. How these guys land and then what they say after in terms of, why they chose what they did. I thought Ben gave really honest answers. I interviewed him. He talked about the Reebok deal. He talked about, different reasons why he chose to go to Bellator over the UFC or even over one championship. Hopefully, Sterling seems like a guy who's not too, who doesn't mind speaking his mind and giving his honest opinion over in the same way. So, you know, hopefully when these guys do sign and, you know, they talk about why they made their decisions, then we'll really have an idea of what these guys are looking for, what the market is like. And trust me, other fighters will be paying attention to that as well.
Yeah. To me, if I'm the UFC, I want to try to keep, you know, you want to try to keep obviously everyone to keep away from the enemy, so to speak, the competition. But I try to keep Overeem because I still, obviously you can headline, you know, Fox Sports 1 shows with him. You can put him on pay-per-views. He's an interesting guy. Still is a visual, and people still know him enough where I think there's something there. So definitely some value there. With Sterling, I think if I'm Sterling, I try to get like a 6-fight deal with the UFC, something that you can do in 2 years, and use that time to try to kind of build yourself up and get that title shot at some point. And I think he's an interesting name. I just don't know if he's going to have the same impact in Bellator that a Benson Henderson would. I think he needs a little bit more time on the, you know, still young, tons of great competition, tons of great fights out there for him. I think he gives himself an opportunity to get another free agent deal. I think that's what a lot of these guys hopefully will do, not get locked into these longer contracts. And a guy like Mitrione, I just hope he gets whatever, basically the highest money that he can, because, you know, he's started the sport late, probably obviously a lot closer to the end than the beginning. At this point, get what you can, take care of your family, and set yourself up as best you can for the future. That, to me, if I'm looking at those three guys, it's kind of where I'm leaning towards hoping they go.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with all that.
And real quick, Will Brooks, you mentioned him. He obviously has not been shy about showing his frustration, on social media before, about the Bellator promotion, both, when Bjorn was there and also now with Scott Coker. Clearly I'm sure he wanted that first Henderson fight. Sure, he lobbied for it and said he's going to test the market as well. See, it's interesting that he is, it just seems like a very, disgruntled champion. And someone that is a title holder for them, has been in big spots for them, but still he doesn't feel like he's getting the love he deserves from them. And it will be interesting to see if the UFC is interested in, picking him up when his contract runs out.
Yeah, I'm sure that they would have some interest in him. And, you know, I think, with Will, he was part of something that Bjorn Rebney built. So not to say that, you know, Scott Coker coming in is a negative for him, but, I think it is, you know, it's like getting recruited at a college and then, you know, your head coach leaves and someone else comes in. I mean, they have different ideas. And I think that Brooks has kind of felt like since Coker came in, you know, and I think Coker would say very differently about this, of course, but I just don't think that Brooks feels like they've ever gotten on the same page. And you can see why he would think that, you know, I mean, Coker bringing in these guys who have bigger names, but yet it doesn't seem like Brooks is really getting those opportunities. You know, Michael Chandler was the champion. And again, Chandler is a guy who was part of the Bjorn, regime as well, but it's hard to believe that if Michael Chandler was the champion, he wouldn't be getting some of these marquee fights. So I can understand where Will Brooks' frustration is coming from.
Someone that has a little bit of frustration these days, but because he is was on the losing side of things and is for the first time in the UFC, Sage Northcutt, obviously going down in defeat for the second round submission last Saturday on Fox. Kind of controversial. Everyone suddenly became a jiu-jitsu expert, which was interesting on social media. And then on Monday, comes out on Ariel Helwani's MMA Hour and says he went into the fight with strep throat. He went into the fight, went to the emergency room to get treated for it, you know, a few days before. And basically it sounded like excuses and what have you, did a little bit of coughing during the interview. And interesting because Sage is now 19 years old, 3 fights in, is arguably one of the, you know, most polarizing fighters in the UFC. It seems fighters get frustrated with him because of the money he's making, which isn't his fault. You have the promotion who's trying to promote him because they think they may have something. A short notice opponent and a weight change, obviously, with Brian Barberena this past Saturday. And then you have Sage himself just trying to kind of figure things out and fight. And you don't know how much of the character you see online and in person is a gimmick, how much of it is real and all this stuff. But it was a very interesting week because now I think there's kind of a weird thing with him now. Like, why do you go and make the excuses and you have people that completely justify it? What did you make of the Sage drama on Monday?
Man, it sounds... It sounds completely ridiculous to me. The one thing I cannot wrap my head around is why in the world was this guy fighting? First of all, remove the strep throat thing altogether. Why was he fighting three times in less than 4 months? He's got to move up a weight class basically the week before the fight because his opponent drops out. So he's training for a 155-pound fight. All of a sudden, it changes to a 170-pound fight. He's like, okay, cool. I just won't cut the weight. I mean, yeah, you can justify these things. But if the UFC really feels like they have something here, and I'm not suggesting that they needed to protect the guy because that is something that you can attack promotions for as well. Like, hey, why are you protecting this guy? But the kid is 19 years old. I mean, he's already somewhat at a disadvantage when he's fighting. I mean, the first guy he fought in the UFC what was his name? Trevino.
Yeah.
And the guy's what, 33 years old? I mean, that's a disadvantage. I mean, it's an advantage in some ways because athletically you're going to be better than the guy, but I just don't understand why the UFC allowed him to fight three times in 4 months. And then on top of that, you find out that they knew he had strep throat. They were pumping him with antibiotics. They've admitted this, you know, and that they just let him fight because he really wanted to. I mean, I don't get it. You know, I'm not saying that with Sage, you got to protect him and only have him fight twice a year and you know, give him these really truly weak opponents. But I think you got to see a little bit when he fought Cody Pfister in December that he had a little bit of a problem with Cody Pfister's wrestling, and Pfister is not, you know, an NCAA world champion by any means. And then you bring Barbarina in and you make the fight at a higher weight class. I think that they put him in kind of a precarious situation. I don't know. To let this kid fight with strep throat, I'm just kind of confused as to why they would do it.
Yeah, I wonder if they were getting pressure from the Fox people at all for whatever. If they just said, you know, we really want to see him in there. If there was something there, if they were just they really wanted to see it. But you're right. He fought a lot of fights in a short amount of time. And it wasn't like, you know, it's not like a McGregor situation or anything like that where the public is really clamoring for it. I think everyone was interested in seeing him fight, but it was just kind of like, you know, time after time, it's like, why did they really try to rush everything in such a compressed amount of time? Because, you know, there's seemingly not the equivalent of his competition there. He's still young in his career, you know, just fresh off this, you know, this run in smaller promotions. And yeah, he won his first two UFC fights, but the competition is supposed to kind of keep increasing as you go up and him changing weight classes. And it just, yeah, it seems weird in retrospect. You mentioned that how they handled the whole situation. Why didn't they slow play it?
Yeah. I can't give an answer to that. And I think that hopefully that will change now moving forward. I mean, him fighting three times in 4 months makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense on any level. It doesn't make sense on his ability to develop as a fighter. It doesn't make, I mean, the guy is not hurting for money. He doesn't have, you know, three kids to feed right now. So that's not the reason why he was fighting three times. I don't know. I think that this could be something that could be positive for him though. You know, now he's saying that he's going to train full time at TriStar. I would think that the UFC and Northcutt will both say, let's slow down just a little bit. Let's not fight, you know, six times in 2016. Let's take our time. Let's develop along the way. And one of the things that I saw on the night of his loss, which it bothered me a little bit, and just because I didn't think it was very responsible, is you had people, you know, basically saying, oh, derailed the hype train. Brian Barbarina derails the hype train. and of course you see that because you see it every time that these situations come along. But no, he didn't, you know. Yeah. Northcutt comes out on one of those hoverboards twirling a basketball, and the thing gets like 3,000 retweets on Twitter. Like, no, the hype was not derailed whatsoever. I mean, people are still extremely interested in this guy. So it's pretty amazing how many different things there are to talk about Sage Northcutt, because he kind of came out of nowhere. He's so young that you really have no idea what he's going to do in his career yet. You have no idea. Nobody does. I mean, he could turn out to be a UFC champion. He could flame out and be out of the sport within 2 years. Like, we have no idea. And it's kind of amazing that he's able to capture our attention so much and keep it. You know, we're still talking about him. We're talking about him over and over and over again. It's pretty fascinating.
When I was thinking through this whole thing, I couldn't help but think of Strikeforce. They had Strikeforce proper, so to speak, and then they also had Strikeforce Challengers, which for people who remember this Friday night, late night shows, 11 o'clock Eastern time. Yeah, late for us East Coasters. But they were basically prospect shows with a little bit of kind of star power in the main event. Not talking title fights or anything like that, but a lot of the women fought on those shows. And it was just kind of this, you knew what you were getting into. They played smaller venues and so on. I wonder if there's obviously so many smaller organizations that are essentially, in a way, UFC minor leagues. I wonder if there is a place where they could essentially create a developmental group or maybe sanction one of these as their official developmental group so they don't get the pressure to bring Sage up right away, but they want to keep him away from the competition. Say, we'll bring you on a contract under our wing, and at some point, you know, we'll see how this goes, and if you, you know, win a few fights, you'll get call up to the main roster. So at least they have control. They can put it on Fight Pass, build some hype, and then when he gets brought up, it's like finally the prospect gets brought up, kind of like what traditional sports do. Do you think there's any merit to that at all? And how do you, going forward, these other young fighters, how do you get them fights but also keep them under control without necessarily exposing them to the bright lights too quick?
Yeah, I think what you're describing would work perfectly well. And with the UFC's relationship with some of these regional shows is obviously strong enough that, yeah, I mean, it's like, this is very, very different, obviously, but it'd be like what they're doing with Cyborg Justino. Mm-hmm. They have her under contract, but she's fighting in a different organization because they just don't have the spot for her yet. And it would make sense to do that with Sage. I think you will see that eventually because it just makes too much sense not to do it. Because as you mentioned, they have to put these guys under contract because they don't want Bellator, World Series of Fighting, whoever, coming in and scooping them up. Kind of lost my train of thought here, but you know what? I think there's also just that there's that temptation by the UFC, and you know sometimes you can't help yourself. You know, Dana White sees dollar signs potentially in some of these guys. You know, I mean, I even talked to him about, you know, why bring in Mickey Gall and have him fight in the UFC before he fights CM Punk, because that means you have to bring in another guy who's basically on his same skill set. So that means you have to sign two guys who are basically not MMA fighters, you know? And I don't mean to classify Gall in that way, because I think he wants to be a serious fighter and he's training full time and all that, but he's not a serious professional UFC level talent yet. But okay, you have to bring him in because you want him to fight CM Punk. Well, now, since you're having him debut in the UFC, you have to bring in Michael Jackson, who has never fought in a professional MMA bout. He really, I don't think his last time he had like an amateur bout was, I believe, 2 years ago. He's had a couple handful of kickboxing bouts. And, you know, Dana said, I thought about keeping Gall on the regional circuit, doing another looking for a fight episode that's just basically completely around him. But then I decided, screw it, I'll just bring him into the UFC, you know? And yeah. I think that you can't really call it necessarily short-sighted, but I think that's what you're looking at is sometimes Dana just wants to bring these guys in as opposed to keeping them on a regional level when he sees that, you know, there's something interesting about him and they have an it factor to him.
We'll talk more about Mickey Gall and Michael Jackson in just a minute. Let's go kind of rapid fire through these last few points. California weight cutting. There was a story, obviously, or a development here this week, and there's been some changes there, some drastic changes as the Athletic Commission tries to be a little bit more aggressive and protective of combat sports athletes. And I wonder if A, what your take was on it, and B, does it mean anything for the major organizations like the UFC, which could just say, we're just not going to run shows there because we're not really down with what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. And I don't really have inside knowledge on this in terms of what the UFC has necessarily told the Athletic Commission, but that is something that they're risking here. I mean, if you create a rule that basically says, you know, we can pull a fight if a guy comes in dehydrated, and then we can tell him that we don't want him competing in that weight class anymore, you know, that's authority that I don't think the UFC is going to fall in love with. You know, the UFC is respectful for the most part to athletic commissions and their jurisdiction. You might have some people disagree with that, but I do believe that at the end of the day, Lorenzo Fertitta does want to maintain, you know, that that authoritative figure in some way, you know, if it's available and if it's there, if it's the athletic commission. But at the same time, these are new practices that don't sit well, you know, with the potentially don't sit well with the UFC's bottom line and putting on fights. So very interesting. I mean, I really like what California is doing, and you know, Andy Foster is the executive director over there, and he understands that it usually takes a lot of time to implement these kinds of things. When you want to make changes to rules and to statutes, it's time consuming and you got to get a lot of people involved. And he's basically saying, no, you don't, you know, we can just do this. And it's going to be very interesting to see if other commissions follow suit. You know, I know that Nevada is looking very closely and watching what's going on. Mm-hmm. You hit the nail right on the head that there's a potential, you know, big problem with this, and that is how the UFC views it. And if it, you know, defers them from taking big shows to California.
Right. Last year they ran two shows in California. So if they were to simply just remove those, not going to be a huge factor. So yeah, I was saying on our Wrestling Observer live show today when we were talking about this, is we're really going to see, you know, when the UFC actually schedules a show, if they schedule a show, and also Bellator as well, to see, you know, they obviously run a lot of shows there, San Jose and Fresno. We just saw a show there. I mean, this really, it just comes down to these promotions saying, we're not going to book a show here because it's just, we just don't want to have to deal with it. And at that point, does California then make changes, and what do those mean? And so I think we'll really see once the first shows are booked there and as we get closer and see what kind of influence they have. So I think we're a little ways off from finding out more about that. And we're not that far away, perhaps, from finding out what happens with John Jones. John Jones and Daniel Cormier, Dana White doing an interview with Fox today, saying he doesn't have a venue yet to announce or a location. I'm sure they have one in mind. But it's looking like April we'll see the rematch, John Jones versus Daniel Cormier, for the light heavyweight title. Many thought Jones a title that still is owned by him. And are you assuming that probably Las Vegas is going to be the destination?
I always assume Las Vegas is going to be the destination. If you're smart and you watch this fight game, you always are thinking Las Vegas, which I got to say, personally, me, I'm fine with. The MGM Grand is 5 minutes away from my house, so I'm never too disappointed when they say that a fight's going to be on the Las Vegas Strip.
That's awesome. What are you thinking about this one? This is obviously a big story. Jones returning and Cormier. This is Cormier's chance to shut everyone up. You know, people that still, even though after that very impressive and fun win over Alexander Gustafsson, and you know, this is Cormier's chance to be like this. No, this is really my title. For Jones, it's a chance to see what we've missed for so long, and to see, has he grown as a fighter? Has he grown as a person? This physique that he's showing off on Instagram all the time, this is like high drama, and I can't wait for it. So I'm hoping it's April.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you cannot look forward to this fight. I think in a lot of ways, I mean, just imagine this. Imagine if UFC 187 in May, Daniel Cormier wouldn't have gotten up from that right hand that Anthony Johnson landed about 15 seconds in. Mm-hmm. You would have been talking about Anthony Johnson knocking out Daniel Cormier in the first round, then probably fighting Bader, and we all saw how that went. So he would have been coming off of a knockouts over Alexander Gustafsson, Daniel Cormier, Ryan Bader, never fought John Jones. John coming back from obviously everything that occurred in 2015. That would have been, I believe, a perfect storm, you know, because you'd have the monster in Anthony Johnson who took over in his absence, and you have Jones coming back trying to regain what was his. The Cormier fight, as much as I'm excited about it, I just don't see what he can do different. You know, and I'll even say that I think a Cormier rematch is much closer than a fight with Anthony Johnson would be. I mean, I'd pick Jones to beat Johnson, but we just saw this fight. I mean, it feels like a long time ago, but it was 1 year ago.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, Daniel Cormier is phenomenal. He's well prepared. He's smart. He does his homework. He crosses his T's and dots his I's. He did that in the first fight. You know, I just don't see this big, aha moment. This is what I did wrong in the first fight, so now the second fight's going to be different. And, you know, I think the intrigue in this rematch is, well, how does Jones look, obviously? Because, you know, he's been gone, and he was doing, you know, obviously some extracurricular things, and he was doing still so well. So what does he look like when he comes back? But to me, I think that puts just a slight little dent in it. And I'm talking with the utmost respect for what Cormier is and how talented he is. And it's not like I'm completely counting him out. But I also do look at this fight as what it is. And that is that it is a rematch that was only necessary because Jones lost the belt for disciplinary reasons. It was not a rematch that had to happen because of competitive reasons. So right. I hope I'm not, raining on anybody's Jones Cormier parade, but that's how I feel about it. I'm excited for it, but it's a rematch that really probably didn't need to happen.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see it. And I think there's going to be a lot of buzz. The guys will be certainly talking. And I think any rain will be cleared away by the point, hopefully in April, we get that rematch. And then, you know, if all the stars align, oh my God, a Jones Johnson fight would be just pure fire. Cannot wait to hopefully see that. Before we go into UFC this weekend, real quick, Cain Velasquez has successful back surgery. Does this, to you, does he get the title shot against Verdum, or can you trust him to actually main event at this point? I would much rather see Verdum, Miocic, and Velasquez versus a Rothwell, some of that ilk, in a co-main event, just because I think that's a lot of pressure to put on Cain again, and you got to see if he's healthy. And I think Miocic has earned it. I realize he's not burning up the page views or anything, but I think you almost have to do that. What would you do?
Yeah, I agree. I would give Miocic a shot, and I was fine with an immediate rematch right after the fight and right after Verdum submitted Velasquez, just because I did think, like, you know, come on. I mean, Velasquez was off for 600 days. You know, you can blame him that he wasn't prepared for the high altitude. And yes, that was his own fault. But I want to see Verdum beat Cain when Cain is, you know, theoretically at 100%. And it didn't look like he was. So I was fine with the immediate rematch. But now, I mean, so much time has gone by. You know, it took so long for them to even put the fight together. And now it's postponed. So yeah, they got to keep the division moving on at this point. So yeah, I think Miocic should get the shot.
Yep, cool. Let's go to UFC this weekend. Obviously, a much different card than it was, as we thought it was going to be just a few weeks ago. We have now the card is obviously on Fox Sports 1. So if you're having a pay-per-view watching party, you get to save a little bit of money there. Johnny Hendricks versus Stephen Thompson, now a five-round main event. Welterweight division, obviously the winner of that puts themselves in a very interesting conversation for a title shot. You have, it's really, you know, the whole card, looking up and down it, is a lot of veterans on the show, a lot of familiar names, people at certain, obviously different points of their career, you know, guys like Roy Nelson, KJ Nunes is on the show fighting against Josh Berkman in one of those veteran versus veteran fights we seem to be getting a lot of these days. Obviously, we talked about the Mickey Gall, Mike Jackson fight, Mike Pyle. I mean, as you kind of look up and down the card, what's standing out of interest to you?
Well, you know, the veteran fights don't do as much for me personally. I mean, I'll just come out and tell you right then and there. I'd rather see someone who's young and coming up as opposed to someone who has gone through, you know, their prime and is you know, still competitive, obviously, but just not in his prime anymore. And so to me, Ray Borg versus Justin Scoggins is the best prelim on the entire card. I think Misha Cirkunov is the closest thing to a prospect in the light heavyweight division that we've got. And he's good, you know, and there's just aren't many prospects at 205 pounds. So he's someone definitely to keep an eye on. And God help me, man. I do kind of have intrigue in this Mickey Gall, Mike Jackson fight. I mean, why not? It's different, you know, and you go to fights and you watch the prelims every single week, you know, as part of my job, that at least it's something new, you know, so I can't even hate on it too much. I mean, I always love watching Joseph Benavidez fight. I think stylistically a matchup with Zach Makovsky is going to kind of the two great fighters, obviously, but it's not going to really produce a lot of action necessarily. You know, I like Roy Nelson, obviously. He's a Vegas guy, you know, always fun to watch. And Johnny Hendricks, you know, is this guy going to be the best welterweight in the world or not? It seems like every step back he has is self-inflicted. So is he going to get it all together and roll through Stephen Thompson and recapture the belt in 2016 or not? you know, I mean, let's just figure it out, Johnny. Let's either do it or not. That's mm-hmm. kind of how I feel about the main event.
Yeah, let's start there with Hendricks. Has been obviously a lot of pictures been posted on Instagram this week. Looks to be in great shape. Obviously, when guys hit the scale and how they look there is important, and then how that translates over into fight night. This is it's one of those interesting kind of matchups because you have Hendricks, who we've known as a guy that can just simply knock people out. Great power, arguably beat GSP that night they fought. And is against a guy, a dynamic striker, the definition of in Stephen Thompson, obviously with his very unique background, has been really coming on of late. It's kind of one of those interesting fights because you can see, I could see Hendricks, just laying in one of those power shots and knocking Thompson flat. I could see Thompson, I wouldn't say knocking out Hendricks, but I could see Thompson almost like outpointing him, outstriking him. And Hendricks on paper, if it's a healthy Hendricks to me, should win this fight. But it's still a question physically of how he's going to be. And I think this is a huge opportunity for him to make a big statement to everyone to say, I deserve a shot at the title and I'm going to win it. And any doubters that I had before, get back on the train because I'm going for it. I think this is a chance for him to really make a statement.
I do too. And, I hope, though, that it doesn't necessarily affect how he's going to approach the fight. If he goes in looking for a spectacular knockout, he could definitely get it. But I do think that he shouldn't overlook Stephen Thompson in the sense of, well, this guy is good, so I'm just going to beat him. I just need to win. And I spoke to Johnny about this fight, it sounds like he wants to make a statement, but then again, a lot of times they always sound like they want to make a statement. So it's hard to discern, whether or not it's going to have any impact on his game. But I mean, let's not forget that this guy's an NCAA champion in wrestling, and Stephen Thompson really had no wrestling up until 5 years ago. And he's done a great job of filling that hole. He's surrounded himself with the right people. He's aware that I needed to learn wrestling when I got into the sport, and he's addressed it, obviously. Wrestling could obviously be a very key element of this fight, I believe, if Johnny Hendricks wants it to be. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, it could end very quickly. I was rewatching fights today, and I'd forgotten Jake Ellenberger dropped Stephen Thompson in the first round. Even though this guy has sort of an elusive karate style, people do touch him. And, Johnny, known for his power, I mean, he could lay him out in the first round. So a lot of different things could happen in this fight. And it is a good fight, and I think I think the fact that it's now five rounds does add a little bit of intrigue to it. If Johnny has not really addressed 100% some of the issues that were going on with him, that might be an advantage for Stephen Thompson that it's five rounds now.
Yeah. Stephen Thompson coming in this fight winning five straight. Obviously, we haven't seen Hendricks since he beat Matt Brown back in March of last year. So a little bit of a long layoff for him. Roy Nelson, a guy that you mentioned, Vegas guy. Interesting spot in his career. He is not won two in a row since 2012, 2013, and has won only one of his last, one of his last seven or so, or last six. He has lost three in a row to Mark Hunt, Alistair Overeem, Barnett. He's fighting, top guys in that division, but at this point, he just doesn't seem to have that. Maybe age has caught up with him. Maybe it's a combination of the health and age and all this stuff. And I wonder if he doesn't beat Rochal, does the UFC decide to take a pass and say we're done, or do they still try to keep going? Does he want to keep going? He's at a very interesting spot in his career, but I also said this before the Barnett fight as well, and here he is on this show.
Yeah, I don't think his job is on the line, if that's what you're referring to with the UFC making a pass. I don't believe that, because this guy still can do ratings. He can still get you highlight reel knockouts. They're still a fan favorite, and they have him under a pretty long contract, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't see them parting ways with him, whether or not he's able to beat Rochal or not. I would think that Roy Nelson's eyes would get a little bit bigger when he sees a fight against Jared Rochal and say, here's one that I should win. And with that win comes twice as much on his paycheck, So I would think that he's looking at this as an opportunity, like, okay, I've been through a murderer's row. Not to say that I couldn't have won those fights, but here's one that I should really be able to double my paycheck on, and get that win bonus. So I just think he's the better fighter than Jared Rochal. I mean, Rochal's gonna come in and probably try to wrestle him and hold him against the fence a little bit, I guess. Roy Nelson should win this fight. And if he doesn't win this fight, you know, and it's not the UFC that's going to be making the pass, but it's almost like, can we sit down and talk about like what is going on, Roy? You know, I mean, I didn't think he looked bad in the Josh Barnett fight, but he should be beating somebody like Jared Rosschalt. So we'll see what kind of shape he's in. That's always something to look for in Nelson when he's going to fight, and whether or not he looks motivated, you know, it'll be an interesting, to see Roy Nelson in a fight that he absolutely should win, because that's really not something that you've been able to say about him, you know, for basically 2 years now.
Yeah. With Rosschalt, you know, he's proof positive that how you win a fight is often as important as if you win or lose when it comes to opportunities and standings and interest. I mean, he is, he's won 6 of his 7 in the UFC, 2 straight, three fight win streaks, riding one now, just beat Stefan Struve. But there's no, it's just the way that he wins. It's that wrestling, grinding 15-minute style. I shudder to think of the fight he had against Timothy Johnson, UFC fight night back in Nashville. That was just a little bit of a dull affair. He's a prospect, but you don't see many people clamoring for him to get bigger opportunities. He's getting bigger names, but he's just kind of a, I hate to say boring fighter, but his style is just definitely not something that sends people on the edge of their seat.
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily that you have to be extremely exciting. I mean, don't get me wrong, that helps tremendously, of course. But you also have to win it in somewhat convincingly. And even though he's getting these wins and, you know, he's not necessarily in a whole lot of trouble during them, it seems like he's always kind of just barely beating the other guy, you know? So there's not even really this sense of, oh, well, here's a guy. Yes, he has a boring style, but man, what if he goes up against, you know, a top five guy? I mean, what if he's able to just wrestle him down and, you know, hold him down and, you know, really shock somebody? Like, there's just not that sense about Jared Rosschalt, because it seems like he's just barely getting by these guys who are questionable UFC caliber to begin with, you know. And yes, he is starting to get some better names, you know, fighting Stefan Struve in his last fight, fighting Roy here. If he gets a win here, I mean, I think people have to basically take notice of him because of his win record and because he'd be coming off of a win against Roy Nelson. But he's just not ever very impressive, let alone being exciting. He's just not impressive either, even in victory. So I think that's what's kind of holding him back.
Final two questions about this card. The interesting fight, light heavyweight with Ovin St. Preux. I guess you could still call him in some sense a prospect, even though I think we kind of know what we have with him now, against Feijão Cavalcante, former Strikeforce light heavyweight champion. He is, you know, Cavalcante, it feels like he's kind of being brought in here to lose almost. I mean, he has not looked good since that positive drug test, and only winning once against Igor Pokorajak, and just has been knocked out. He just does not look like the same fighter, and I would not be surprised to see if he's being brought in here to be fodder for Ovin St. Preux, who there's still, you know, obviously there's still some mileage on him, I think.
Yeah, there's some mileage on him. I don't think that there's necessarily a lot of expectation in terms of, you know, this guy could be a title contender. I think that ship has kind of sailed. It hasn't sailed completely, but, you know, St. Preux, he still kind of strikes me as the same guy that he was a year, 2 years ago, and he's 32 now. He's not 27.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that this, you're probably right. This is a fight. I don't think the UFC put this fight together, you know, rubbing its hands together saying like, oh yeah, we'll get St. Preux a knockout, and then, you know, he'll be on the rise again. He'll be this guy who can headline cards and, you know, potentially win a title. I don't think that's what this fight is. At least that's not how I see it. I don't know that St. Preux is going to look outstanding against Cavalcante. I mean, he doesn't really bring necessarily anything to the table that Cavalcante hasn't seen. But just based on the fact that Cavalcante gasses as much as he does and has just seemed flat-footed and pretty done, you know, since the positive test that you mentioned, I think St. Preux will get a win. How impressive, and, you know, is it knockout? Is it a highlight reel kind of deal? I'm not really sure, but it's just not a fight that interests me all that much, to be honest.
And finally, if Joseph Benavidez defeats Zach Makovsky, he'll have 5 straight wins. I mean, I get that people don't want to see him get another shot at the flyweight title, but how can you deny him at that point? I mean, does he basically earn a shot at some point with a victory on Saturday night?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, we don't know when Demetrius Johnson is fighting next. I would think that it's going to happen in April. That's my guess. But so I don't know necessarily what the timing is going to look like. But Yeah, I mean, Benavidez, what else can you ask the guy to do? I mean, he beats everybody. Ali Bogotinov is not an easy fight. You know, John Moraga is not an easy fight. Dustin Ortiz is not an easy fight.
Yeah.
And you know, he's beating all these guys. So, yeah, I mean, it's difficult to get back into a title fight with someone that you're 0-2 against. But, I mean, it would just be unjustifiable if Benavidez didn't get a title shot after this.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, this long UFC run that Benavidez has had since the WC merger. He's got two losses, both to Demetrius Johnson. That's it. He's beat everyone else. And yeah, I think it's wait for a title shot or move up. And yeah, he's in one of those tough spots, but obviously he has to win against Zach Makovsky on Saturday night. So before I let you go, obviously you've been more than gracious with your time. I want to give the floor to you, plug away where people can interact with you on the social media, any work you have upcoming for the shows this weekend, and the floor is yours.
Well, in the social media realm, I guess I'm already getting behind the game, man. At 30 years old, I'm an old man. I only have Twitter. I mean, I don't do the Snapchat, and I guess I have an Instagram, but I never get on it. So If you want to contact me and interact with me, Twitter's the way to go. It's at B Okamoto, OKAMOTO, ESPN. You know, I'm on there. I love talking fights, so anybody can hit me up talk to me on there. And then, of course, my work can be found at ESPN.com. And we do videos, do fight predictions, news stories. You know, I dabble in everything. So head over to ESPN.
And obviously, you can see him in the front row, press row. I'm always trying to pick out people that I remember I can recognize. See, and you're always there. So you're a constant at all these UFC shows. Do you go to every single show?
I do. No, no way. Absolutely not.
Are you sure? Do you have like a stunt double or something like that that goes to some of these?
No, man, I do not go to, I think I would die if I went to every single one. They're having so many and they're so spread out these days. But, you know, I make my way to quite a few fights and, I'm fortunate, man. Yeah. I have a great seat. I get to cover the sport. It's pretty wild. It's a great trip.
Well, obviously, UFC coming up this weekend. Brett told you all where you can read him. So, once again, Brett Okamoto, thanks so much for joining Josh Nason's Punch-Out this week.
Of course, man. Anytime.
So, I hope you guys enjoyed that. I thought it was a lot of fun. Brett's a great interview. No big surprise there. So, again, Brett Okamoto, ESPN.com. Let him know that you enjoyed the show if you liked it. I always like seeing those tweets. And makes me feel good, and I'm sure it makes them feel good as well that their time was well spent. And obviously, again, appreciate you guys listening, spreading the word, and the positive comments. So it's keep the show easier to do every single week. So let's get to really quick some of the news that broke over the past couple hours since I recorded that with Brett. Let's see. Let's start with our title fight first. We have a rematch happening at UFC 199. Let me actually bring it up on our site, which, of course, is WrestlingObserver.com. We're going to see the rematch. Luke Rockhold, the middleweight champion of the world, taking on Chris Weidman in a rematch from their classic bout in December. A back-and-forth battle early on, but one that Rockhold just took over and steamrolled him at the end. That's going to headline UFC 199. However, we don't have a date on that yet, other than it's going to be in June. So we don't know the exact date. We don't know the exact venue. Dana White mentioning this on the Garbage Time with Katie Nolan show on FS1. So that is also going to be the show. We talked about Mickey Gall. We talked about Michael Jackson. It's also expected to be the show that CM Punk is going to debut on as well. Interesting that if that ends up happening, and again, that fight being on UFC 199, what I thought would be the case would be for them to hold, to see weight. Here's what I thought was going to happen. I thought that they really were going to try to get Anderson Silva on the UFC 200 show in a title shot situation. That was my gut instinct, is that they were going to wait and see what happened with Anderson Silva and Michael Bisping coming up on this Fight Pass show. If Anderson Silva won that, my instinct was that they were going to try to get GSP somehow to come back on the show and also do Anderson Silva on the show. That mainstream fan familiarity, I thought that was kind of what they were going to go for there. But apparently that's not the case, because obviously they'd be fighting against the winner, Luke Rockhold. I assume they were going to hold him off. And clearly he's not going to come back in a month notice to fight Anderson Silva. So that plan seems to be off. So that's interesting for UFC 200. Rematch fatigue is something you guys are probably hearing a lot about these days if you listen to a lot of podcasts and so on. And I'm hearing a lot about it too, and I'm feeling it. I don't know if you guys are too. It kind of just, you know, we're in for good fights, but I think we're in for new fights. And I think we just had so many rematches over the years, ones that we didn't necessarily ask for, ones that we may have not really wanted to get, but ended up turning out okay anyway. I just think this, the lightweight division, Frankie Edgar, Mr. Rematch, you know, Benson Henderson, Mr. Rematch. And we've just seen so many. Cain Velasquez at heavyweight. You know, I think we're in this era now where people are they want to see fresh opponents. They want to see more title fights for these top guys. And I don't know. I'm just not into rematches right now. And especially if it was close, it makes it easier to sell it to me and makes it more of interest. This one, again, it was close early, but it really didn't turn out that way. And I don't know if I want to see. I want to see Weidman again to get a title shot. I don't know. I'm not really into this, but we'll see. Obviously, as it gets closer, we'll watch that. And clearly, you know, Weidman's got a big risk in this. If he goes and gets trucked again, man, that's not good for his career at all. And with Luke Rockhold, obviously a loss here would lead to a third fight. Who knows about that? But kind of looking at the stories here, David put in his story, Rockhold had told us several weeks ago he's expecting Weidman next, and that would have been the case even if Yoel Romero wasn't facing a suspension. He said he was asked about both and felt Weidman would do a better job selling the fight. To quote Rockhold, Yoel Romero can't sell a nice Cuban hell. Not going to waste my valuable time fighting some chump for change. I want to fight for real money. If I'm going to invest 3 months, a person better be able to fight and sell it. Fans have to demand the fight. I don't know if that either case was going to work for him, but you know, there's not a lot of people that can actually sell fights. So if that's what he's waiting on, you know, I guess we'll see about that. So that with that out of the way, the other news that broke tonight was that Donald Cerrone needs an opponent for UFC Pittsburgh coming up in just a few weeks' time. He was supposed to fight Tim Means. Tim Means getting flagged by USADA, and that is usually obviously not a good thing. Basically, Means took a took an out-of-competition drug test and got popped. So flag is usually the result of a positive drug test, but obviously fighters are given the chance to appeal, which is good and right. However, that process takes a while to do. So it's not a case you can appeal like, say, in Major League Baseball or some of these other sports. You can appeal, and while you can appeal, you can still play. So the case with this is he can't fight until this is actually resolved, which is unfortunately something that wasn't collectively bargained, unlike anything of USC. But, you know, Cerrone's been a short-notice guy. He fights against anyone. This was going to be his debut at welterweight in the UFC. And a lot of people were interested in it. Again, it's a Fox Sports 1 card, so it's not a big deal. There was not a lot else on that Pittsburgh card, so I feel bad for those fans, especially if you're there and you're listening to this right now. I feel bad for you guys. But hopefully they'll get an interesting opponent for Cerrone. My guess is not going to be anyone of marquee value, but you know, we've been surprised before, so we'll see. So that was the other news that came out tonight. Tim Means, of all people, getting flagged for out of competition drug stuff potentially, and we'll have to see where that one goes. So with all that being said, we're going to let you go for the night. Appreciate you listening. Obviously, you can follow us here on the site, WONF4W. You can follow me at Josh Nason, JOSHNASON. Appreciate any comments, notes, constructive criticism, all that good stuff that you have. You can also email me, josh@wrestlingobserver.com. I do not believe there is a UFC event next week, so I think we may be off. However, that doesn't mean you're not going to have some new audio to listen to. And that'll be a little bit more apparent as we get closer. I think a project I've been looking to do and revive from the dead, some retro stuff might find its way to the website. So I'll be telling you about that in about a week's time. So with all that said, thank you for listening. Thanks to Brett Okamoto. Thanks to all of you. And we're out of here. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.